Well, let's see what happens. Hello, and welcome to The Talking Show. My name is Brett Lawrence Thompson, and I'm filling in for Steve. My name is Brett Lawrence Thompson, and I'm filling in for Nicholas. It's a few minutes after the hour, and they haven't shuffled down the hallway as they usually do around midnight on a Wednesday night. So I figured, let's take a little moment and get on with the show. I am Brett, filling in for all of them. I do the 8 o'clock sets, and every other week I station manage. And this is The Talking Show. Yeah, I don't know why they're here exactly. Was it something I said? Ha ha ha. I kind of get the gist. But I really do believe in this show. I think that the Chinatown micro broadcasting airwaves would be remiss if we didn't always have a talking show once a week, as this is one of the longest running talking shows we do have in our Chinatown broadcast station. So let's be labor on. Now, tonight we have something a little different. Oh, but first, as I'm filling in for Steve and Nicholas, let's cover some of the ground that is normally covered by The Talking Show. Usually, those two scamps talk about the changing tide in Chinatown from week to week. Well, let me tell you this. On Ord Street, there is a great new New Orleans restaurant. I can't remember the address, but I hear it's simply scrumptious. Scoops is on Broadway near the coffee house. That's a Starbucks, which is a little bit corporate for our Chinatown area, but we tolerate it because it's open till 11 and it's Starbucks, so how can you get around it? That's, you know, it's like not tolerating smog in Chinatown. So there is a Scoops, and even though it's dipped to around 74 degrees, Scoops is delish. And us at The Talking Show and us who station manage The Talking Show love to go to Scoops as much as we can, and you should too. In Solomon News, there is a new tree outside the station. We can see it from the window. In celebration of autumn, Solomon has put in a tree that has those five-leaf structures, and it's beautiful. What Solomon did was he put in one of the few browning leaf trees that you can see. So as we look out from our beautiful new console that was installed around 6 weeks ago and is by Radio Systems, we can see that fall is upon us. And now, one of us must say, well, I guess, you know, I'm not going to talk like them. I'm just Brett. And in fall, I, like Nicholas, suffer from allergies. They're bad. But can I say, oh my God, so are the fans. One sec. And welcome back to The Talking Show, with Brett L. Thompson setting in for both Nicholas and Steve. Okay, what other things did they say? I got the idea for what to do tonight from Steve and Nicholas from four episodes ago. Four episodes ago, they played a piece by Lydia Lunch. Lydia Lunch was here. It was from circa 1991, 1992. It was late Lydia, if you do archive her by eras. And when I heard her, it reminded me of that era because I was there myself. I don't know if many people really know about me. I am just the lowly station manager most of the time. I'm kind of a gearhead. I do my little show at 8, and then I hang around all hours of the night being sort of party host central and just engineer guy, and I hit record and I watch the clock. And that's what I normally do, but tonight I do get a chance to tell a little bit about myself and who I know and where I came from. Tonight's episode is about Joe Cole. It's not from the words of Joe Cole, because Joe Cole has left us a long, long time ago. Joe Cole has passed, but many, many, many people love Joe Cole, and some are worthy of note. Personally, I met Joe Cole after I was working at Capitol Records. Now, I'm a true Hollywood kid, which kind of puts me at fundamental, maybe even odds, with the normal K-Chung fare. Normally, K-Chung people are properly schooled, go to private facilities, and they're just a great bunch of gals and guys. Me, I was born on Sunset Boulevard, and I went to elementary school, like behind where Guns N' Roses rehearsed. I remember seeing all kind of crazy stuff on the street, and you know, it's, we had a sockball court back then, but back then that was when the sockball court was where somebody would get high and overdose on heroin, and you just see it from the sockball field, and you didn't know if you were supposed to play around it or not. But there was some woman that was blue when I was 9, and God dang it, I really liked playing sockball. So like all my other fourth grade chums, we all just sat there. Anyhow, life in Hollywood. The nice thing about Hollywood is that you do get access to the music industry. And in my late teens, I was working at Capitol Records as an A&R talent scout. And then I heard some material by Henry Rollins. Now, at Capitol Records, obviously, it's a major label. They were doing major label things. As I remember, they were trying to wonder how long they could keep selling Poison records at the time. And sometimes it was a little bit embarrassing. They were also still selling MC Hammer, and they had a bit of that, what is that, Robert Van Winkle, Vanilla Ice. It was kind of a strange time, but I was a kid, and it was A&R, and I loved it, and I was a scout, and they fired everybody else and kept me, and I kept on going, and I was getting A's through UCLA, so I guess in a way I was having a ball, but in a way I was missing something else. One day backstage at a concert, I met someone who had called and attacked my A&R department to me. And rather than allow me to defend our A&R department, which was actually indefensible, she hung up on me very loudly. And I met her backstage at some huge gig a few days later, and everybody went, ooh. And I said, actually, I thought that was really cool. Who are you and who do you manage? And she managed Hank. And she told me to come by her office. I was still very young, barely out of high school, and her office at the time was based across the street from Hollywood High. They've knocked that building down years, years ago. But Henry Rollins' operation used to be on a three-story building, and you'd walk up, like it was like kind of a long walk up, one of those old Hollywood places, and that's why they knocked it down. And on the top floor, they had 21361, and then a recording studio that would master all of his spoken word stuff. And then his management lawyer was in the back. And I remember the first time I saw Joe, it was when he dropped a whole box of t-shirts damn near on me. I opened the door from the bottom, and Rollins was not doing that well then. He was just off Texas Hotel Records. And he was touring a lot, and like a lot of punk groups at the time, he was living off t-shirt sales. So what Rollins did was he'd take his tours, and then he'd have a huge bundle of t-shirts that would go out with the tours, and they were all black and white print. And basically, Joe Cole realized that why walk down a three-floor walk-up if there's just shirts in there? Because what Rollins used to sell was non-fragile material. Rollins used to sell t-shirts and books and not so many records at the time. In fact, yeah, Rollins wasn't selling a lot of records at the time. But so what would happen is somebody would scream something like, "Huh!" And then a whole box of t-shirts would just come spilling before you. And if any flew out, then they just put them back in the box and put it back on the truck and then send it out to Rollins, who was in Idaho or wherever he was trying to continue on with his life. And the first "huh" I heard was Joe. Long-haired, beautiful, piercing blue eyes, 6'2". Darn it, I'm almost describing a love interest, but a lot of people would say that when describing Joe Cole. He was a very, very memorable guy. And I was just from a major label, and I had long hair in a punk facility. And Joe treated me like a long-lost cousin or somebody really to be treated well. It was really, really awesome. And that's something that everybody would say about Joe. Nowadays in LA, this is 20 years ago, the clip that I'm going to play you from, and I'm going to say that in advance. Like, this isn't from now. This isn't somebody I just ran into in the street. Vintage stuff. What Joe would do is he toured starting with Black Flag, then he got picked up by, of course, Rollins Band, and then in between those tours, he would also do a lot of stuff with Sonic Youth and some of the other SST bands and post-SST bands. Obviously, Sonic Youth wasn't really an SST band. They're East Coast. But nowadays, everybody forgot about Joe, which kind of is fine by me, because everybody used to ask me questions about what he was really like, and it's one of those things that's very difficult to explain. And Henry Rollins, Hank, used to talk about him a lot, and he used to come up a lot. And he kind of put a kibosh on that and just, you know, stopped, partially because the blowback to, I'm sure, him, because they were so infinitely close. They were like two sides of, well, he'll tell you himself. It's tough. I remember when Rollins took off, back when I was in my band, and my band was got interest, and I have a whole music career and whatever. I wasn't born to station manage at 1 a.m., I think. And Rollins was doing that show 120 minutes. And this was a few years later. And it was a Spike Jonze video of a Sonic Youth single called 100%, and they still talk about the video because Spike Jonze shot it after he did all that seminal girl stuff and before he really got big with the Beasties and all that. So it was a really important video as a video, but the video was about, well, the quote by Henry was, "And there was a song about the death of my best friend and skateboarding." It's tough, man. It's tough when you lose somebody that's as dear as Joe. Basically, let me say a couple things about Joe. Okay, so like I said, at 213.61, Rollins was not getting any money from any of the Black Flag stuff. SST is notorious for never paying residuals or anything to their catalog artists. No one knows exactly where the money goes, but it didn't go where it should. So Rollins was always one of those guys that always had irons in the fire. And what he did was he released a bunch of books that he liked. He was doing decent as a spoken word artist. And what else would he do? Oh, and then of course the t-shirts and then all kinds of Rollins swag. So what Joe would do was, while I was going to the back, he'd grab me and he'd say, "Hey, Brett, do you have one of these?" And he'd give me like some really cool Rollins Band t-shirt, Lifetime. He gave me the Lifetime t-shirt, and it's kind of got his tattoo on the back. It was before he could afford colors. And he's like, you have one of these yet? And of course it was from money that they really needed. And I was like, "No." And then he'd just throw it at me and say, "You do now, Brett. You should wear it more." And then another time, Joe dragged me into that same little room where they had all that stuff that everybody was surviving off. And he said, "Hey, Brett, did you ever read this book?" And he handed me Last Exit to Brooklyn by Heath Selby. And I said, no, I was, what, 19? You know, I wasn't really down with Hugh Selby. And he said, Brett, you got to read this right now. Dude, just take it. Just take it. You got to take this. And then another time, I don't even know whose cassette this was, but he grabbed Fugazi's repeater for me on another day. And he's like, Brett, you need to hear Fugazi. I can't believe you didn't see Fugazi. Why didn't I see you at Fugazi? It's an $8 ticket. You gotta get down with Fugazi. The next time they're coming to LA, I need to see you at Fugazi. But until then, learn this album. And Joe, everyone from Highland to Melrose to Venice, everyone has hundreds of Joe Cole stories like the few I told you now. I was younger, and when I grab people now and I just, hey man, you gotta do something cool. You gotta get into this. They look at me like I'm nuts, but I'm not as cool as Joe Cole was. But I know it's the right thing to do to try, and I can't do it every day, but sometimes the days add up, touch wood, and I do my best. And finally, I did meet Hugh Selby. I met Hugh at Joe's funeral. I think Rollins is going to talk about this. I haven't listened to this bit in 15 years, but I know the talking show relies on this kind of stuff, so maybe it's time just let Henry tell his story for you talking show loyal listeners. But Joe and Henry lived on Brook Street, which is now a very nice place in Venice, but at the time it was very crackheadish. And they were living there because there were no SST royalties. And Henry was just getting by, and Henry was on the road most of the time. Henry would tour spoken word with anybody because he needed the money to subsist and keep his music in the Rollins band going. And even when he got Wartime signed, which is an interesting side project with Andrew Weiss, it wasn't that much money that he could just stop touring. So he kept a nice place in a bad neighborhood. And everybody thought he had money that he didn't. And I always thought it was nuts because I knew where he lived because I worked for the management. It was a very small management team. It was me and Gail, and I worked for Gail. And I always was like, why is he doing this? And now we're in a world, and I'm at a station that considers itself very punk rock. And I remember punk rock funerals. And punk rock funerals sometimes happen because punk rocker A never paid punk rocker B. It happens all the time. There's another case. Ginn, bless him, one of my favorite guitar players, top one punk rock guitarist. He wasn't right about a lot of that stuff. And I even talked to him when I was working for Gail. Shockingly, he called with something, and I don't know the money. I was just an assistant. But he was apologetic, and it wasn't what it was. So something happened. In life, something always happens, but this time it was something pretty horrible. A punk rock funeral, I don't even know if they have them. I don't know what punk rock is anymore, other than a bit on Portlandia. But I remember standing with half people in suits and dresses and half people in punk rock clothes showing their tattoos, and everyone was tremendously sad and endlessly confused that they were even there, because if anyone lived life for everybody, including himself, he was one of those guys that lived a great life. You could see it in his eyes, and he'd just kind of pull your hand back into his life. You know what he did? One time, Joe saw some lyric sheets that I had laying around, and I'm a pretty good lyricist. That was, you know, At K-Chung, I get in a lot of trouble because of my emails, because I'm a very strong writer. But Joe read some of my writing, and this was just like a, you know, demo thing, whatever. And he's like, Brett, did you really write this? And I, yeah. He's like, dude, we're gonna book you as an opening act for Henry Rollins. And I was like, I'm Brett. Look, hey, Joe, thank you, but I am not a spoken word artist, and I'm definitely not a Henry Rollins. And he said, neither was Henry when he started. We'll just put you out there. You'll go on before Hank, and you'll talk your lyrics until you run out of lyrics, and then you just start talking. That's exactly how he did. We're going to do it for you. Oh, Joe. And, yeah, and then he was gone. At the funeral, before we went up Forest Lawn, I was standing in a little like punk rock bunch with Hugh Selby, who I did meet. I read your book. Oh, wow, really? Yeah, Joe gave it to me. And Thurston was there. Courtney Love was there. This is well before... this is before she became, you know, Courtney Love with a capital thing. Yeah, Hugh did the headstone. I think it says, you can't kill the soul. And I hope that's true. I do remember that Henry wore... all black. Henry was one of the guys that didn't wear a suit. Everybody who dresses for that particular day felt like they wore something absolutely wrong. I remember Henry with his jack boots, you know, those 90s jack boots. And we were talking after that, and he said, I want to say goodbye to Joe again. And then he ran up this huge hill at Forest Lawn all alone. And everybody just watched him run up it that was just kind of still milling about. And then he kind of walked back down. And yeah, and Joe Cole was very, very special to a lot of people, including me. I wish I could be half the man at 40 that he was at in his late 20s. Here's the bit.
This is a story about two boys. One boy was born in California, conceived in the Midwest in 1961. Another boy was conceived in Washington, D.C. and born in a snowstorm in Washington, D.C. in 1961 at D.C. Columbia Hospital. Each boy grew up feeling totally alienated, totally weird, totally convinced that he came from a different planet. Each of them had one stroke of good fortune. They crossed paths, and it was just by sheer luck these two aliens crossed paths. They became incredible friends and had a friendship that was beyond words, that was beyond thought. They could finish each other's sentences. When they were together, they were so telepathic, it's like they were brothers. It's like they shared the same mind. When they were together, they used to call themselves the Chosen One. Everything the other one said was awesome. People around them used to say, why don't you guys just get it over with and fuck each other, okay? The two would laugh at them and know that these people had no idea how cool the other one was. They would argue with each other, you're awesome. No, you're awesome. No, you're awesome. No, you're awesome. But you're the man. No, you're the man. I guess I am the man. You are. No, but you are. On into the night. They would watch really stupid movies for their comedic impact. Anything with Sylvester Stallone. The more serious the movie, the more the boys would laugh. They worked very hard in the living room, aping Sylvester Stallone's sagging face. They dissected the movie Over the Top as one dissects Moby Dick or Ulysses. They got down every nuance of Sly's tortured face. They believed they were the funniest, coolest, most awesome guys on the planet. Together, they were invincible walls of mirth. They did so much cool shit, you will never be able to finish a book about the two of them. The epic movie could never be made because Lawrence of Arabia was 4 hours and it was too long for theatrical release. This would have to be about 50 hours and just no one would take it on. And you couldn't release a film called The Two Most Awesome Dudes Who Ever Was. The two guys spent years together traveling through many countries, going through high times, low times, times of no money, no hope, no chicks, no friends, nothing but each other. A little while down the line, one comes into some money and says, "Hey man, you're living in that dump. I got this cool place over here. And you're awesome, and you can't be living in a dump. Why don't you live here?" And the other one said, "That's great. That way we'll always be together, and we will be the chosen one. The mind will be in full effect at all times, and Earth will come to us. We will be awesome at all times." And each one knew the other one was right. So they shared a house, and it was amazing. They went to the Whiskey a Go-Go one night to watch a band. It did not matter what band it could have been. It did not matter who was with them. No one survived the treatment they gave people. It could have been Black Sabbath in 1972, their common favorite band, and they still would have bagged on Ozzy because everything was funny when they were together. So the two of them are watching a band at the Whiskey, laughing until they urinate their pants at how funny the band is, when actually the band is kicking much ass. They're making it into the worst gig on earth and having the greatest time. People are passing them, recognizing both of them and saying hello. The two say hello back, and once the person who said hello turns away, they make stabbing motions at that person's ass with air knives. And laugh and high five and bond even further. The two boys were a walking riot at all times. Maybe not to anyone else, but each other. They left the Whiskey, and they went all the way through West Hollywood towards Venice, with their middle fingers out the window, flipping off all of West Hollywood and Westwood. Very mature, but they thought they were the funniest fuckers on earth. And they were. They got back to the house in time to go to the video store to rent Rocky V. And they even started getting ready for the movie 2 hours before they would watch it by looking at each other and saying, "Go for it. No, you go for it. No, you fuck me. No, I'll fuck. No, you fuck me. No, I'll go for it. No, you go for it. Hey, you gotta go for it, right? You gotta pull out of the womb, right? With the monkey wrench. That's why half my face doesn't work. And that's why I'm over the top. You see me when I'm going, when I take it and I take it over the top. You see my face and I go, eh." A lot of people said I'm an idiot, right? But I'm very erudite. I mean, if Mel Gibson can do Hamlet, I can do Macbeth, right? Look, to be or not to be. See, I can do that, right? A lot of people don't know that I'm a very erudite and intense actor, man. But one day people will see my full potential. They think I'm a meathead. But what they don't understand is I'm worth $160 million, right? They might hate me, but I can buy them. The two boys laughed all the way back from the video store knowing that Rocky V was going to be the greatest movie ever made because those two would be watching it. And they decided that right before the film, they better go get some food so they can eat hearty as they watch this incredible film that's going to make them laugh until they piss their pants. They go to the store and they buy their food and they're walking down the street making fun of Sylvester Stallone like there's no tomorrow. And they're 30 feet away from their shared home and they're laughing saying, hey, you go for it. No, I'll go for it. You gotta go for it. If you don't go for it, someone else will, right? And then you're just standing around. That's why I go for it all, right? And some of the films I make, right, are kind of stupid, like that one, Rhinestone, right? A lot of people say that guy's a moron, right? I mean, that movie's so gross, I can't even watch it, right? And right then, two guys came out of the bushes and put guns in their faces and said, this is a holdup. And the two guys went, okay. And the boy who was born in Washington, D.C. was told to get on his knees, and he got on his knees and he had a gun at the back of his head. He looked over at his buddy who was born in California, and he looked down and the boy from California is lying face down on the sidewalk with a gun at the back of his head, and then a moment later, the two boys are ordered to get up and walk towards their own house because they were going to go inside. The boy from Washington, D.C. is the one who had the key and knew very clearly that once they were taken in, they were going to be marched into the back room, told to kneel down on the ground, and they would be shot execution style in the back of the head. So the boy from Washington, D.C. realized they had about 45 to 60 seconds to live and was vainly trying to figure out a way to turn this all around. The boy from Washington, D.C. opened up the door, took five steps in, dropped the groceries, saw that the TV was on, furiously thought of an idea of maybe trying to give these two sons of bitches the VCR and the television, and maybe they would just go the fuck away. When the boy from Washington, D.C. heard a slight scuffle, bang! He ran out of the back of the house, ran up an alley, made a left, made a right, made a left, went to a phone call, dialed 911, and said, I live at 809 Brooks Avenue in Venice, California. And there was a shooting at my house. Can you please come here? So I walked into the middle of the street, not knowing what the fuck to do with myself. 30 seconds later, a plainclothes cop car comes racing up the street towards me, orders that I go to the side of the curb and put my hands on my head. They arrest me, throw me in the back of a car, drive me up to my own house, and keep me there for 20 minutes and make faggot jokes outside the car and point at me and call me sweetie. I keep asking in vain, can you please tell me what happened to my friend Joe Cole? He might want to know how I'm doing. He might be scared. I need to talk to my friend Joe Cole. He's my roommate. He's my best friend. Where is Joe Cole? And the cop says, sweetheart, just calm down. We need some details on your partner. My partner. And the cop said, yeah, what's your partner's name? I said, my partner, my roommate, my other half is Joe Cole. He's 30 years old. And can you please take me out of these cuffs? I haven't done anything wrong. Why have you arrested me? I need to talk to my friend. Do you need the key to my house? You might need to get in there. Some guys had guns and they put them to us and there's a shooting. Can you tell me what's going on? Finally, one cop sits down in the car and he's working on his piece of paper on his clipboard. I said, excuse me, sir, my hands are turning blue. And also, can you please tell me what happened to my friend Joe Cole? And the cop turns around with a very studied nonchalance. And he said, oh, he's dead. And went back to his clipboard and wrote like it was no big deal. So they held me for about 9 or 10 hours at the police station and let me go in the morning. And my friend took me back to my house. And we were preparing to clean up as much blood as comes out of a 6'4" young man who gets shot in the left cheek. And I was getting ready to mop up that living room, and me and my friend were saying, we can do this, right? Yeah, we can do this. We're getting psyched up to mop up so much blood. And we get to the front porch, and there's television reporters there, National Enquirer, and there's a big puddle of blood right on the dirt on the front porch, and there's flies eating it. And I look down, and this puddle of blood is very big and very deep and very viscous, and there's a lot of flies eating my dead friend's blood, and that was Joe Cole, man. And so I went by the reporters. I've never said no comment to a reporter in my life. I said fuck you a lot of times, but I've never said no comment. I felt like I was in Watergate or something. So I walked into the place, and I had to go right into Joe Cole's room and get his phone book and call every single fucking number in that phone book from A to Z and tell them the most horrible news I could think of. Between phone calls, I would have to steady myself so I wouldn't start crying and convulsing. I would have to calm myself down so I could make the next phone call. So when I talked to that person would hear a voice and not somebody on the other line going. So I did that for a while. And then it took us a couple of days of frantic moving, and we moved every piece of furniture and gear out of that house and threw it in a storage space, and I lived in someone's office for a few weeks and went on tour. And I'll tell you what, man, all that talk about kill a motherfucker like it ain't no thing and all that tough gangbanging shit, you know what? I think it's fucked up and stupid. Because when someone dies, it's not like in those movies, like Lethal Weapon 3, where they just die, and you know how Mel seems to kill people and never has to really answer for it, and the bodies stack up, and afterwards he just, you know, paid $7.50 to see a lot of cars blow up, a lot of silicone impregnated breasts and a lot of dead bodies. You know what happens when people get shot? They don't like struggle for air and say something witty and dramatic as they die. They just fall on the ground, shit their pants, and their brains come out the back of their fucking head, man. The last few months have been really hard. It's been really rough, but there's one upside to the whole thing. Because, like I said, I got enough horror to sink your ship, okay? And who needs to hear it? It just will bum you out, and it's just a self-indulgent blues jam. And I'm not going to pull you through it because I pulled you through it enough. There's one good thing that comes from this. When something this powerful happens, there's a powerful lesson you can get. And here's what. I'm not trying to say I'm some goody-goody, you know, oh, I love you all, and that new wave shit. But look, I don't know many of you people. I don't even know how many of you are here tonight, but I'll tell you one thing. I like all of you, all right? And I don't like all of you. Like, I want to move into your house. I want you to come over and hang out with me and shit. I mean, but I like you. I really do. And I'm really glad you're here. Not because you paid whatever to get in here, because you're alive. And I don't even know you, and I love your life because you got one. And if Joe was here now, he'd be here, but he's not. And I don't believe in an afterlife. You step on a bug, it dies. I shoot you in your face, and you die, and you don't come back. And that's my belief, okay? There's no ghosts. There's no afterlife. I'm not a spiritual person. I'm a kind of a cash and carry guy, wash and wear. So, with that belief in mind, I reckon that while you are here, since you're not going to Disneyland and all that shit and hang out with Jim Morrison and get to jam with Hendrix and Miles and all that cool shit, if I were you, I would really kick a lot of ass while you're here. Because when you die, when you're dead and you die, you're fucked. Because you don't get to go hang out and do cool shit anymore. So if you're thinking of going home and putting a fucking needle in your vein and shooting heroin, always know one thing. At least my opinion is, that's fucked. Okay? Glorious thoughts of suicide. If you ever kill yourself, I would love to be able to bring you back to life just so I could kick your ass. I think there's just no time for drinking this Jack Daniels poison. There's no time for hanging yourself. There's no time for blowing your brains out. There's no time for heroin. As bad as life is, people like Daryl Gates, you know, people training you to be a racist moron, there's a lot of bad shit out there. And as bad as life gets, life is fucking awesome, man. Because the alternative, going to a funeral, looking at a little plastic box that contains your friend, sucks. So all of you are the same on one level. All of you in here are just like me in one way. You're all breathing. And that's the coolest, man. And you have to go with that. Because there's nothing else to go with. That's the only break you get. You get to live tomorrow. You get to go on. You get to move forward. And it might not seem like much, but for me, it's right now, it's all I'm hanging on to. And it's all I've got going. And it's what I'm going to stick with. So, on that note, I just want you to know that I hope you had a great fucking time tonight. I want you to live two ways, long and strong. Good night.
And that was Henry Rollins. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, I forgot it was a talking show. One sec, let me lower this so I get the really loud sense, little sound thing. Yeah. After a really good piece like that, there really isn't that much to say, especially if you were around then. I do remember the phone call I got. It wasn't from Joe. It was from Linnea at Warner Brothers. And she just said, Joe Cool is dead. And I did not know what the hell she meant. And when she told me, for 5 minutes, it was just complete and utter disbelief. I'm sure I, like tens of people, maybe hundreds, have gone over the events of that night. The murderer has still not been found, so it keeps popping up on these shows on like channel 105 on Dish and whatever. It's still out there. It's just some punk rock tragedy. And I don't know, who knows what about young death. Witnessing young death and having someone you really admired be in that position, it makes you one of two things. It makes you a wistful little talkative punk who wants to say, oh, it's me, it's me, it's me. And you kind of take on their pain, or it makes you very, very quiet. And I took the second route. I work at Kaechung. There are over 100 DJs here. They know me as a gearhead and kind of an oddball. They don't know my punk rock roots. They don't know that I forewent some label stuff as an artist and some label stuff doing A&R to work for $100 a week just because I heard this side of Sweatbox that I haven't been able to find for 20 years since, of Henry Rollins just expressing himself so deeply and effortlessly. Man, if Steve and Nicholas were here, they'd know exactly how to say this, baby, but I'm just the station manager. I only have my ins and outs. For me, this is very late. I miss Steve and Nicholas tonight. I don't know if they're asleep or awake, wherever they are. If they are, sweet dreams. The show must go on. The talking show has gone on. And maybe if anybody from Kaechung is up very late, they know a tiny bit more about me. If you want, you can visit Joe. I think it's Forest Lawn Hollywood, but it's the one that's really in Burbank or whatever. Thank you for listening to the talking show tonight, and have a pleasant sleep. Or if you're listening to an archive, have a lovely rest of your day and week and month and year and life. This is Brett L. Thompson filling in for Steve and Nick on your talking show on Kaechung. Thank you.